This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me is Darius Thomas.
Is that what I have to expect as I get older?
You know Too Tall, an award-winning creative studio that specializes in animation and illustration for sports. Greg Walter is the founder and boss man of Too Tall. After getting his start with his co-founder Ian in kids animation, they built Too Tall and pivoted into sports. Starting with no clients, no contacts, and experience working with the likes of Sesame Street, how'd they become who they are today? Let's dive in.
47, Justin. 50 is the new 40. 40 is the new 30, except when it comes to Justin.
You're going to be that old man who's going to like feel the weather coming in your knee. You know, you're going to be like, storms are coming.
Storms are coming.
What if social teams could execute on-brand creative from their phone in under 90 seconds? Well, now you can with Team Plates. It's no secret that we're in a time where content needs exceed internal resources. Social teams want content ASAP, and creative teams want to maintain brand standards. My mission with Baller FX is to make motion design more accessible, so we've set out to create a product that frees your creative team up by allowing non-creatives to execute on-brand content anytime, anywhere. Your team, custom templates, delivered on time, on brand, in seconds. Email Justin at ballerfx.com to book a demo. That's Justin at ballerfx.com. Today we have Greg Walter of Too Tall with us. I'm going to read a short little about section because I think it encapsulates quite a bit about Greg that we're going to dive into here. It says, I'm the owner and creative director of Too Tall Animation. My job is to pump up fans, stoke community pride, and build tribe for clients like Puma, Chiefs, Cavs, Amazon, ESPN, and dozens of other sports and lifestyle brands. Before that, I used to write and produce original educational and scripted shows for kids. So, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us here today.
Awesome to be here. Really honored to be on the show. Big fan.
So we usually like to start by hearing a little background on how people got into the industry, and I think yours is going to be interesting just because of your background in working on the animated kids shows and not necessarily being in sports right away. I actually recently got a message that said, this gives me hope. I'm not in sports right now. I like to hear about the stories of people who didn't start in sports that now work in sports. And I know you kind of straddle that line working with lifestyle brands as well as sports brands as well. So can you start by giving us a background on how you got into the animation side of things? I guess we'll start there.
Yeah. So a long time ago, I'll make this brief, but I was an art major in college. Did nonprofit for actually a number of years. I didn't even do art for the first 5 years out of college. But eventually I got a job doing art for a reading tool for kids called Head Sprout in Seattle. And I learned animation on the job there, because the reason I didn't get into art actually for a long time is because I really wanted to find a way to give back and do something to help the community. And when I saw an opportunity to use art to help the community, to educate kids, I was like, okay, this is a place where I can intersect with my two interests. And so got a job there. That's where I met Ian Mork, who has been my creative partner for 25 years. We both worked there together. And I learned animation on the job, learned storytelling on the job. It was one of those great places where everybody had the chance to do every job. So you would take an animation from writing to design to animatics and final animation. One person would do the whole thing. So I just learned a ton about all that stuff. Did that for about 12 years. I moved out from Seattle to Ohio. Eventually got laid off from that job as they got acquired, and Ian Mork did as well. And I started Too Tall. And initially, I was really hoping to continue what we were doing with educational content for kids. And also was doing a little bit of kind of video explainer stuff, because I was starting from the scratch in the middle of Ohio, and I really didn't have any contact out here. So I started up Too Tall, did a bunch of stuff. We did like stuff for like Smokey Bear. I wrote a lot of songs. That's the thing I used to do a ton, is like writing educational songs and stuff like that. So I wrote this cool Smokey Bear song, wrote a whole bunch of stuff. If you really look back in our archives, you can hear me rap. It's disgusting, but it's there.
We need to find that.
Did a lot of that stuff. And we really wanted to make a business out of that. So So Ian and I tried, and about a year later, I hired Ian on. So we tried to make a business out of doing media for kids, and we did some stuff that I'm real proud of, some stuff with Sesame Street that is some of my favorite work that I've ever done, a bunch of other stuff. But there came a point where we realized that the industry didn't support what we wanted to do there, because the kids' media sector is really interesting because they really, really value quantity above quality. Like, people want a lot of stuff that will keep kids in place for a long time, and they don't necessarily care how good it is. And so what Ian and I really wanted to do is we wanted to keep getting better at our craft. We needed to be in an industry where we could get paid enough that we could keep getting better at what we do and also hire more people on who were high quality in what they do as well. And we kind of hit a brick wall where we could either like make zero money but make good work, or we would have to race to the bottom with the industry. And so what we decided to do is it seems like a really weird jump, but we decided to move into sports. We had done one project with the Seattle Sounders. We loved it. But like intellectually, as I was thinking about it, like we had to move away from kids media. Branding is where we could have gone. A lot of the branding work that we were getting and we were seeing is just really safe. If you're not working for certain brands, people are very risk averse in branding. And so when we were looking at that, we were like, okay, this could be interesting, or it could be us just doing a bunch of junky video explainers and we're in the same boat as we are with kids media. So what we saw in sports was a few things. First off, there is a huge thirst for innovative content, and then there's a lot of competition for eyeballs on content. There's a real value on short form content, which I love doing, like not really long stuff, but like really applying a high level of quality to a short burst of content. And there's just an adventurousness about the storytelling and about the people who were putting content out there that was really attractive. Also, for the kind of work that we did, which is more of a character-based work or illustration-based kind of work, there weren't a whole lot of players in the industry that we saw yet. So we thought that we could carve out a nice niche in the sports industry. I knew no one in the sports industry. There was no reason we should have done this, but it sounded fun and we really needed to take a big swing. So we basically shut the studio down for a few months and we worked on just putting out content, passion project content. And then we started putting it out there and trying to get people to see it and share it and stuff like that. And we were able to get it in front of enough eyeballs that a couple of people took swings on us, and we slowly made that transition over to sports over like the next 2 years. And now we're probably 90-95% sports in the work that we do. And it was a huge change in style. It was a huge change. There's a lot to learn. A lot of contacts that needed to be kind of made from scratch, because as I say, I didn't know really anyone. But it ended up being a successful move and have really enjoyed working in the space ever since. That's probably about 5-6 years ago.
That's awesome. And it's funny that Justin was going to start with that, because when he read off that you were in children's animation, you know, having been around a lot of youth and kids, just the sheer volume that it takes. And it's obviously, and I know that you are going to, you know, go into some AI influence and all that we've seen over the last couple of years. But if it wasn't for like if you could just do it on your own schedule, produce at your own like kind of schedule and volume, would you have stayed in the children's media spectrum, or do you think that you would have eventually just gotten tired of that anyway?
Honestly, it's like, love working in sports. I would return in a second, and not because like I like it better than sports, but it's an area that I felt at the time like I was born to do this thing. And like, if opportunity presented itself again, I'd consider going back. But I would never like stop the momentum that Tutal has. Like, I would keep the team in place to keep doing what we're doing. But if I had a chance to go back and write songs again, I still, and that's what I like about the, about doing this NBA stuff. And I know we're going to talk about that on our socials, is like, it's a return back to the old cartoon stuff. Like, it's slapstick. It's like simple stuff. So I would return to that stuff if they'd have me, and if opportunity presented itself. But right now, like, I'm real focused on the momentum we have in the sports space.
It's funny hearing you talk about the quantity over the quality, because I remember like watching shows with my kids, and I'm like, man, they love this show, but the animation on it is seems kind of like glossed over. But
yeah,
you know, it makes sense. Everybody has certain things that they care more about. Obviously, the kids are not going to be worried about. They want the story and the music.
They
want
to hear the songs.
They want all of that. So it's interesting. Can you dive into a project that you did with Sesame Street or something in the kids genre and talk us through like the execution phase of all of that?
Yeah. So we did two shows. I'll do the Sesame Street ones. I did two shows for them. One was called Henrietti and one was called The New Neighbors. Henrietti is probably the, what I still consider kind of my best work as a creative director and writer. It's about a Yeti who is living in a human world. She's big and strong and beautiful is her, you know, her song is what she sings about. A very positive body image kind of show is what it was meant to be. It was a response to a call out that Sesame put out for new shows for their online platform. And they were taking pitches, and I'd kind of had this one in my sketchbook for a little bit, and pitched the show of her living kind of in a mixed family. She's one of four adopted kids, and no one ever refers to the fact that she's a Yeti. Like, it's just like, it's just, she's just a kid in this world. But we pitched the show. The thing you sign on for when you do that, though, is that they own the IP when you develop these shows with them. And so I knew at the time that I was signing on for not having a lot of creative control over the future of the thing that I'm doing. So from there, what it was, they loved the idea. They wanted to develop it. I wrote some songs. I wrote some scripts for it. And then we produced it mostly in-house, but with a couple of outside animators, and put it on their online platform. A couple of the songs, a couple of the episodes of that were really big hits online. One of them, you know, went around to film festivals around the world, won some big awards and stuff like that, and was really very proud of the kind of the work that we had done there and the characters that we had built. And so the thing about making this was for like a preschool audience. I don't know if you ever watched Bluey or something like that, but like, it's very well written. It's very good. It's really hard to write really good preschool content. I don't think if I went back, Darius, if I went back to kids media, I would not go back to preschool. It is horrible. It's horrible because 90% of the ideas you'll have, you're like, oh, well, you can't do that because a kid might try that, or a kid might say that again to their parent or something like that. They're like, ah, man, I got all these good ideas. Like, this would be freaking hilarious. And then you do it and they're like, well, you know, we actually can't do that thing. So it's you're in a very tight box. What's up?
Has to be why. The you know, there's PG. I've learned that there's also Y, which is like what you're talking about.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming it stands for youth, I think is what it stands for, but
probably, yeah. So that was a tough design space, but within that very tight box, I was just really proud of the work we were able to do. We only did four episodes of that. It went on. It's apparently, this is where the contract I signed bit us eventually. It's apparently being developed into a full-length show. We have not been invited to participate in its development as a full-length show, so there's a longer story. That one's not one for over coffee. That one's over for like a stiff drink. Another reason why, you know, I don't regret getting out of the industry, because it's actually really, really incredibly competitive. And actually getting a show, the next step after what we were doing would be to get a full like TV show, which is, if you're climbing a ladder, you know, the next rung. And then we got to a rung where I looked up and the next rung was about 40 feet up. And that was basically, you get your own show is the only way to like make a viable business out of this thing. We did pitch shows. We did a bunch of stuff like that. None of them got picked up. It's just an incredibly competitive industry, and it's really hard to be one of the things that breaks through. Even though we had something that was really successful, it had you know, a lot of social proof as far as parents, kids, you know, festivals, success, things like that. It just didn't, we never kind of got to that next rung.
So with that being said, now with social media, YouTube being monetary avenues, have you kind of thought of going that route in the animation space to kind of take advantage of that? Because even though now things have been made easier in a sense with new technologies, quality for, you know, people like us, we still value quality over, you know, the quantity space. But is that something that you've considered as kind of not really a side hustle, but as a extension of what you do?
Great question. And that's what we really want to figure out, what the next steps will be with our social channels. We had a big success last year with the NBA eliminations series that we did. Got a lot of fans now on that platform. We're going to do it again this year and see if it can grow even more. And then what we're going to do is we're going to figure out, is there something we can do to extend that platform into something that we can monetize, you know, through sponsorship or through taking a similar concept and building it for someone else on their platform to try and build up their crowd, build their fandom.
Fanatics, they seem to be going all over the place right now with different people. I feel like that would be perfect. So maybe there's someone that'll hear it and take it up the pole for you.
Yeah, they're on the list. We need to get in front of them. We got in front of a few people already this year, and we've talked to them. And I think that my takeaway from this was, we have a lot more negotiating power and a lot more gravitas behind what we do if we can show that it's replicable, mm-hmm. And it wasn't just a fluke doing it once and having kind of a one-time mm-hmm. thing. But Fanatics is on the list, and I might hit you up if you have any contacts there. Because this thing did blow up. I mean, we started off with a follower base of 6,000 people on our Instagram and TikTok channels. There was nobody there, and 300,000 after 2 months of the NBA Finals, 150+ million views. Really, really caught on with people. People really liked the format, liked the content, and so I think we have a platform now that we could build something in, but it will be for a sports audience. I don't think it would be for a kid's audience. We just need to figure out how to make the correct next move, because it's not ready quite yet for monetizing in a big way. And it's not ready yet for IP generation in the way that it would need to be. And so I love working with clients. I love taking people and working with their message and getting out to the right people and stuff like that. But I mean, I think all three of us know that, like, working on the with clients entirely, it's a real roller coaster as far as, like, you have very little control over when you're going to get projects and things like that. And so if I could find a way to create IP that we could even out our revenue stream and have total control over our creativity, like, I would take it in a heartbeat. Like, it'd be awesome. It'd be fantastic. So either as a side hustle, either as something that we are supplementing the IP, the client work with, or potentially as something that we would break off into two things. Those are kind of things that we're looking at right now. And a lot of that will be determined by what happens over this NBA playoffs and how fans respond to it. If we stay with about the same fan base at the end of it, it'll be a different set of decisions than if it takes off even more and we get a bigger fan base, because then we have just an incredible amount of proof as to, like, you know, what this concept has the potential to be. And we can start with confidently telling somebody this thing actually has replicable legs and can be moved to your platform or can be a great vehicle for your sponsorship, stuff like that.
What do you enjoy most about animating?
Well, that's a good question. I wasn't on the list, Justin.
As you can tell, he's just free flowing.
No, what do I enjoy most about animating? I love the point. Creativity is hard. That sounds like a really dumb thing to say, but like there's the early part of this process that is the most important part of this process. Where if you get it right, everything else falls into place, the initial ideation, the creation of an animatic, figuring out of a style, putting together mood boards, trying to figure out what the who the audience is and all that stuff. That stuff is really hard. And that stuff is the stuff that I can't farm out to anybody else, that I have to do myself. And it's the most important thing, but it's my least favorite part because it's stressful as hell. I love in a project when you get to the point where it's like you're running downhill, like all those decisions are made and you just got to get into production. And, you know, we work with a lot of contractors and you've pulled in the contractors and you're like, hey, expert here, you go hit this thing, you go hit this thing. And everything's clicking on all cylinders like a well-oiled machine. Like, I dig that part of it. And I don't do, well, I'm trying to get more out of production just because the studio needs me to do less production and more creative ideation and leadership and stuff like that. But I love, man, I could just sit on After Effects or on Adobe Animate all day and just be happy as a clam just animating. So like, I love production. I love the little tweaks. But I also love like creatively leading like a team of animators, and you know, Justin's seen me dance, like doing the little dances where I can like show animators what to do, how to do this thing, and then sending that off to them, and having this like, we got this great animator who's in Australia, and it's awesome because it's like you send stuff out to him in the evening, and the morning you wake up and it's Christmas morning, he's got all this stuff under the tree for you. I love that. I love that part of the process too. So yeah, I would say it's a long answer to a really simple question, but like I love production, I think is probably the short answer to that. But I value more the hard part, the hill you have, the pushing the boulder up the hill is the most important part. The most fun part is chasing it back down the other side.
I love it. That's a great answer.
Thanks.
Yeah. So when you're developing, you mentioned the playoff and the NBA playoff stuff. And I know you added Wembanyama in there now too, but I think the reason why it jumped off is because you're blending the current events and the cultural aspect of what fans are saying and what audiences are focused on with these players, and you're bringing it to life in an over-exaggerated way. How do you come up with those concepts, and how much do you listen to the current events and what's going on to make it hit home a little bit harder?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the first time we did this, we actually did this in 2021, but we did it kind of as a synopsis at the end of the playoffs. And it's kind of, and so we had like the, you know, the benefit of hindsight. And we were able to like incorporate a lot of stuff into it. But this time we did it last year, we would release these the minute the buzzer sounded at the end of the game. Like the second the buzzer went off, you had to be able to go to our TikTok or our Instagram and see it there. It was already there. So in order to do that, you have to prefab everything. So it was a combination of some things, some gags that were kind of more generic, where we just had to have some slapstick gags in there. People explode and people getting hit by hammers, kind of whatever. And then some of them we were where something funny was happening in real time, and we were like, okay, we got to grab that and just make it fast. And the way we built out the characters in that, we built it so that we actually can put something together the same day if something happens, if there's an inside joke. But we always we have a backlog of a few things that are already animated, some kind of generic gags that we can throw in there. And if we are kind of like even in the ballpark of showing that we get the different teams and the different players, it feels like it's customized in the final thing. Let me see how I can say this right. Like if we can make it feel like something that Joel Embiid would do, that if they win, if the Sixers win, it's going to seem almost, someone's going to be able to tie it back to something he did in the game, because it's just like a thing that he would do kind of thing. So it's one of those things where if we nailed it, what we actually did is we got in the ballpark, and then somebody made the mental connection that made it look like we nailed it a little bit. Because we can't pick up something from the game and put it in the animation. The animations are done before the game starts. We have, you know, whatever we need for the end of that game ready to roll. ready to deploy. As soon as the buzzer goes off, it's already uploaded to TikTok generally, and I just need to hit a button at that point. So it's a combination of those two things.
Yeah, and I guess I'd be interested in diving a little bit into the character animation side of things, because it's something that I personally am not interested in getting into because of how long and tedious it is to actually animate characters. Takes a lot of time and energy and effort. So for you to say that this is all pre-built and you're obviously making a change, or you have two different versions already done and uploaded depending on who wins, is interesting. Are there any times when you feel like you can make a jump to animate a character in a certain way that helps you save some time and doesn't cost you a day to be able to do that?
To a degree. We're looking into making these things a lot more easily swappable. Like, for instance, if we put these together in a really, because we've been just kind of scrapping these and slapping them together kind of like on the fly. But if we were building a whole property out of this and we knew we were going to be doing it for a long time, we would engineer this so that like we build one thing and then put it into After Effects. The animation's in there, and based on a variable we put in there, it could be anybody we want who we've already designed in the NBA. So if there's somebody hitting somebody with a hammer, we could say, hey, you know, now it needs to be Jalen Brunson, you know, and just like kick that out. We don't have that yet. We swap stuff out manually. One of the things that we do get, because animation, custom animation, is incredibly difficult and time consuming. One of the things that we actually get a lot out of, we can extend that often. And if you look back at our work, you'll see us sneaking this in all the time. If you can do a dance loop, some sort of a loop that's like, I don't know, 4 seconds long, and it loops over and over again, you can make a lot of scenes out of that thing. You can recombine it in different ways. You can put on different backgrounds. You can do different effects over top of it. You can kaleidoscope it. You can layer it. You can tile it. You can do a lot of, you can gain a lot of ground off of one thing that's looping. And that's the only reason we were able to do this thing, is because each of our players has a dance already set up. It's going to be the same way throughout the playoffs, unless they do something that's going to change it, like Jimmy Butler last year, we turned him into like a Hulk. So we can get a lot of room out of that. And so the actual animation load in each one of these things is generally about 2 seconds long, like one gag and then back to the big group of people dancing. So we're doing a project right now that I actually can't go into details, but like, you know, one of the ways that we're extending things quite a bit is we're having the players do dances, and then we are just remixing them over and over again to cover a lot of ground. So there's a few things like that. Like if you can get a client on board for that, we can extend our budget and extend the amount of time that we can cover by doing looping things. And honestly, sometimes the end product is way better, because people at some like base level of entertainment just freaking get the giggles when they see somebody dancing. Like it's this like, I remember this is, okay, let me digress real quick. When we worked for this reading tool for kids way back in the day, we'd bring kids in to like test how they did on the reading program. They'd have like video cameras, we'd observe them and stuff. And so we sat back and we watched them looking at our reward sequences, which were the animations that they get when they get things correct. And they would watch through these things that we had spent like 2 weeks on building this story, because we were building this world with all these characters, and we'd have like these long storylines and stuff like that. And they'd look at those and they might smile, but they made me just be like attentive, but just looking. The minute you just slap on a character just doing a goofy dance, they'd lose their shit completely. Like they'd start bouncing in their seat, they'd start giggling, and then no matter how long it goes on, they would not get tired of it. That's one of the biggest lessons I've actually ever learned in animation, is sometimes you just got to keep it simple. And if there's something like some base thing that you can like touch really easily, you don't need to overthink it and do something big and grandiose. Sometimes you can just hit that thing that people respond to at a base level, and it's a shortcut to like an emotional response that you can tap without having to create these big, long narratives. I don't even remember the question I'm answering right now, but for some reason that digression, oh no, it had to do with extending stuff. So sometimes just having a looping dance, whether we're making something that looks like a music video, or whether we're doing something that's like these NBA playoffs things, you can do that. You can use that as a shortcut. Nobody cares. In fact, they might like it even more.
I'm just visualizing all of the dancing and moving as you walk through this. We talked about this a bit pre-record about the effects of the elephant in the room per se, AI. How much of that do you look at as this isn't going to replace anything? This is only going to enhance what you're able to do. Like if you're able to, engineer something that can speed up a workflow, it's not necessarily going to replace what you do, but it increases what you can do.
Yeah, AI is tricky. No one knows what's going to happen, but I think it does make sense. I'm not going to sell out what we do or change our fundamental business. If we get overcome by that and I have to get a new career, so be it. But I'm going to die on that hill. But at the same time, like if there are things we can do that speed up our process and allow us to put out great custom content, but do it in a more efficient way, but do it in the same way we would have done anyway. I don't want to steal anybody's style. I don't want to steal anybody's stuff. Like I don't want to put anybody out of work. I want to keep hiring people. I want to keep the industry afloat as much as we can, as far as keeping great creatives working. But there are going to be efficiencies. And we are looking into them, especially if they can help us create, more content for less work. We're going to be looking into that. I haven't used it a ton, but it's something I'm keeping an eye on and constantly talking to people about. Like, hey, what are you doing? Like, what are you finding helps with your load? So I think no matter what happens, and nobody, like literally anyway, everybody can predict, but nobody knows what's going to happen. There's no way of knowing. I think it is going to lead to prices going down for content, because you will be, like right now, you're competing with overseas. You're competing with junior operations and overseas. But we're adding machinery to that now, so it's almost like what a craftsman was competing against. First, it was competing against the cheaper person down the road, and then it was competing against a machine that does the same thing. And so, trying to keep my eye on, well, what can those things not ever do, and also what can those things do to kind of help us at a base level do our thing more efficiently? It's kind of how I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point about it's not just the battle of, AI. It's, it is the person. If you're in animation, I could do an animation for, this short amount of money. Like it's multiple battles, and both of you working in motion and animation, I'm sure that like there's nothing that can fully replace what you all do in a sense. But the question that I want to ask both of you is, Justin, I know with what you're doing in your space, you're trying to make some things easier. But also, where does the customization, the customizing become the commodity then? Because like even if you make it, to where any team could use your system, or any team could, you're swapping out that animation with one player to the next, I think that's the ceiling. But then you're gonna have some brand or team saying, everybody else is using that, I want this. Like, is that what gives you some sort of relief, is that some teams or some people or brand will still want that custom effect to separate themselves from the crowd? Or do you think people will want separation?
I feel like it's going to it's kind of what Greg said. So back in 2017, when I was with the Celtics, we started exploring AI, and we actually started using it for our backend infrastructure because everybody hates logging. I think I could say that.
Yes.
There's very few people that will sit there and go, I love logging. Okay, so what if we train these faces and trains the numbers and it trains the jerseys, the numbers, the names on the back, and trains the logos of our partners so that when partners come to us and say, hey, we want this player with our logo in video that you've shot, we can execute that. And so my thought process has always been, how can we use AI to leverage our content in more ways so that we can deliver more content, free up our content teams in order to execute when they don't have to be involved in every step of the process. And I hear a lot of people talk about, hey, if, especially in the animation space, if we can get AI to remove a background, if we can get AI to remove the wires, that's all the tedious stuff that, hey, we can spend more time being creative. So the way that I've thought about it is, how can we use AI on the backs of creatives to free them up to be more creative more of the time while still delivering on more of the content requests and everything that content teams are facing? So I think that probably goes hand in hand with what Greg responded with in the last answer. But I think that's the best way to think about it. Never mind the fact that we're going to have some legal parameters that come into play. Just thinking back to the music industry a handful of years ago, when they started using AI to actually crawl and search all these different teams that were using music to see if they actually had that music licensed or not. And there's a lot of different things that, technology and creative is always going to be ahead of the legal side of things, and they have a range that they can go back and come back and try and sue people on. So I have been a little bit hesitant to dive into some of the Midjourneys or Dollies or whatever because of the music side of things. But on the other side of it is, I'd rather see us leverage it for the use of better creatives and creative power.
Yeah, I think there's two different avenues for AI. There's AI as a finished product, and then there's AI as a tool for creatives to use. I think AI as a tool for creatives to use is going to be just like having more tools in Photoshop and in After Effects and things like that. I think AI as a finished product, nobody knows yet, because it can do all these things, and it's just going to get better at it. And in 5 years, it'll make a whole motion picture that you probably couldn't tell the difference between something that somebody could make and AI could make. So it seems like for AI as a finished product, we still don't know what's going to happen with litigation. We don't know what's going to happen with legislation, and we don't know what's going to happen with backlash. We are human beings. At a certain point, we're not going to sit around like the guys who are floating around in WALL-E and just take it all in. Human beings are not going to want to be fed machine stuff forever. But I don't know exactly what's going to look like. There's going to be some of that. Like if you're going to park your kids in front of something, you just want them to climb up for a little bit so you can do your thing, which is unfortunately where a lot of kids' media is used. Something that's made by AI, the kid's not going to give a shit about, kind of we talked about before a little bit. But if somebody knows that something is made entirely by AI, it's going to hit different than if they know it's made by a person. And I think at a certain point, people will want and need to have labels on stuff so they know. I think people would demand it. Again, I can't even predict if that's going to happen or not. But I think in the combination, somewhere between litigation, legislation, and backlash, there's going to be some attenuation to this thing. It's not going to just take over everything and all of a sudden everyone's out of work and we're all, doing nothing. It will be there, but I don't know if it's going to take over everything as a finished product.
Agreed.
But it is scary as hell.
It's interesting because what you had talked about earlier with the kids' animations and content, and you felt like they wanted more quantity over quality. And I feel like that kind of dovetails into the sports industry a little bit, because the, you know, people complain about, oh, all they want is quantity over quality for some parts of it. And then now we're talking about AI and how AI is probably going to be help drive more quantity with maybe some quality, depending on how you look at it. Seems like it's just like an ebb and flow of quantity over quality and kind of moving towards where you can be in a space that values you and your skills and what you bring to the table.
Yeah, and that's not a new thing. It's been going on for forever in different ways, but it's just that this AI is an accelerator to that same concept of, you know, quality over quantity. I mean, I think that one of the things about AI is that since you can do it, since you can, like, pretty soon, once everyone gets access to Sora AI, you can make woolly mammoths happen, and you can make anything you want. That's all going to get flushed into the system by everyone. And so in a world where anyone can do anything anytime and flush it into the social media, flush it into everywhere, you know, at that point, what's going to surprise people? Like, there's so much stuff in there. People want to be surprised. People want to be delighted in some way. They want to be challenged. They want to see something they haven't seen before. So in a world where you can make anything happen, it almost seems like the next, like, big thing that we all need to figure out as creatives is, like, in that world, how do you still surprise people? You know, it might be going back to, like, stuff that only humans can do, you know, something that can't be done by AI, or it can just be, we need to think of creative ideas that no one's thinking of to get into this world. But I think that's what's going to be. There's going to be so much flushed in to the system, not by the teams, not by big media producers, but just by anybody with a social media account is going to be able to do this stuff that it used to have to be done by Pixar. And in that world, in that, like, glut of content that's actually really high quality, how do you still surprise people? How do you still get attention? So I think that's our challenge. Like, that's how we all stay relevant, is if we can answer that, and if we can create content and help people create content, you know, help clients, like, figure this thing out too, then I think that we may still be relevant for a while, hopefully.
I think that's probably a good segue into talking about some of your client work, seeing stuff that you've done with Puma, Amazon Thanksgiving football promo, and those kinds of things. So when you said that you didn't have any contacts in sports when you decided to get over to sports, if there's people listening that don't have contacts in sports, be curious to hear how you ended up getting those contacts and where you started in trying to develop those relationships with some of those teams and brands.
Yeah, great question, man. Like, okay, so let me even think back step by step. So we did one thing with the Sounders. We really liked it. We got a couple of people who came to us from that and said, hey, we are interested in working with you. And none of those things actually worked out, but the people, we did get people in through the door by kind of making one piece of content that people saw. So we had a bit of an in there. But when we were just making stuff, we did some Seahawks stuff, because I'm a Seahawks guy. We did some Russell Wilson stuff. And then we would just put that on social media, put it on LinkedIn. And then I just watched to see if, like, the three people who I knew in sports would just like it, so that maybe somebody else would see it. And if they didn't, then we'd make something else and we'd just put it up there. And I'd approach those people and say, hey, we'd love to do something like this for you. Or we'd love to just, like, hop on a meeting with you guys. We're really interested in doing some more work in sports like this. But I think that the main thing when I got laid off from my job and started Tutal, I also had zero contacts. Like, this is not the first time I've had zero contacts, but it's a long uphill battle. And what it is to, like, torture a basketball reference, it's just like, it's finding a place to plant your pivot foot and then pivoting to whatever the next thing is, like figuring out where to plant your next foot. So, like, we got the Sounders thing. We had that under our belt. We had a foot down. So what's next? So we were like, okay, we can use this to like build one more thing and then hopefully get those contacts to do that. If we can get somebody else to hire us to do something else, we'll basically do it for whatever they'll pay us, because we need the social proof of saying that we worked with a couple teams. So I think the Pacers came to us next. And when we did the stuff with the Pacers, you know, we had all the time in the world. So we really dug into who they were, who their audience was, what they were trying to achieve with their communications of that season. And they were really open to that. And we created something that hadn't really, that I had never really seen before, which is kind of the first of our living murals animations, where we animate plays from basketball and we put them on the walls of the city in a video. And we were very conscientious about how we did that. You know, we wanted them to go, we had their social team go around to the local neighborhood, take photos and videos of buildings that people would walk by on their way to go to a game, empty walls, and then we would fill those walls with animations of the team. And this was like one of those things that we just wanted to like get this feeling that the players, the team are basically the team and the city and the fans are all one thing, and the players are drawn on the walls of the city itself. And if you are walking around the city, you're seeing them 40 feet high on the walls around you. And for the Pacers, we wanted to make sure we did it on a lot of brick walls, you know, a lot of really material things. That is, as we wanted to stay away from big skyscrapers and stuff like that, because that's just not what Indianapolis is known for. That's not what we thought people would resonate with in more of a Midwestern blue collar kind of city. That's a long digression, but like what I'm kind of getting to there is we put in a lot of extra calories on that one. We didn't have a big budget because we knew this was a shot at getting that next pivot set up. And so if we put in a lot of calories and we really did it right and we really did something special that people hadn't seen before, then that would give us a lot more strength on making that next pivot to the next thing. And that's how we have kind of done everything. It's like, it's not a good way to make money, but like if it takes a while to kind of like, sometimes you got to do some cheap shit, like not cheap as in bad, but like you got to take
your own marketing dollars in something basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the payoff you're getting is in credibility, not in money for a little bit. And so we would just do things to build our portfolio and to get social proof on what we were doing. And then hopefully also do something that when we put it out there, people would see it and be like, well, I haven't seen that before. Let me get in touch with these guys. And we've gotten a ton of work out of that video that we did with the Pacers, because people were like, this is new. This is interesting. This makes me feel in some way that I different than other things that I've seen. And I want something like this for my team. So we've probably done, I don't know, 5-8 projects kind of in that same kind of style for different clients. So I think that like very conscientiously, like figuring out what the next step is, like, you know where the mountain is. As long as you know you're going towards the mountain, you don't have to get to the mountain in one jump. Like, just as long as every time you step, you're stepping closer to that mountain, you're making good decisions to kind of build the road to the thing you want to get to, then you can slowly make your way in. And if I could go back again and do the sports thing again, I also would have just spent a lot more time with people in person, talking to people instead of behind the computer creating stuff, like going to conferences, things like that. Something I've never done a ton of, but need to do more of, talking to guys like you. You know, just talking shop and just doing that sort of stuff. So I think that that's really important, to be a face as well as a portfolio. So I would advise people to do that as well.
I'm glad you said that. There's always conversation on the new age of creatives who are trying to like jump into the industry, and they're always, hey, if anybody has this, can you talk through some other ways that, you know, and you said not just worrying about the portfolio and building the portfolio, but just simple conversation of, hey, I'm interested in this industry. Not I want a job or an opportunity, give me an opportunity, but just learning about it. You know, I tell people all the time is that if you want to get into an industry, you should spend time talking to people in that industry, not trying to be a BCAM or a junior designer or junior whatever, trying to get a job, just have conversation, whether that's 15 or 30 minutes. How valuable do you think conversation is versus trying to get like the labor part of the experience?
I think it's really valuable, more valuable than I think I ever gave it credit for too long. And I regret that I didn't go back and do a lot more of it earlier, because I probably would have accelerated what I was doing a lot more. Because I mean, the thing, like, people have really, really finely honed shit detectors, and people are busy. Like, if it feels like you're contacting somebody because you need something from them, it's not that they're bad people. It's just like, you know, we all get a lot of this stuff and we only have a certain amount of time. But like you're saying, if somebody's like, hey, I really want to get into this industry, and you can tell that they're a go-getter and that they're, you know, that they just kind of want to learn more, I'll usually make time for those folks. Like, I really want to learn about what you do and stuff like that. I think the other thing would be, I like it when people contact me and they have looked at the work we do and they've figured out a way, or they position themselves in a way that makes me think they can make my life a little easier. Because I think for everybody, there's two motivations for most people who are in the industry. Like, as far as if somebody comes to them, like, will you make me look better to my boss? That doesn't apply to us. Will you make me look good in front of my boss? Or will you make what I'm doing easier? And if you can do either of those two things for a client or for somebody who you're approaching, people are going to look up a lot more often than if you say, even just something like, flattery is great. Like, I feel like I could learn a lot from you is great, but that puts that's like, will you be my teacher? And that's them saying, hey, can I volunteer you to do something for me? But if you can do something that makes their lives easier in some way, then you're giving something. You're trying to give something, and B, you're controlling your thing. If you can make my life easier, I'm the most appreciative person in the world, because I can get very busy. And if we bring in a new contractor and they go the extra mile and they communicate and they take something I give them and they knock it out of the park without any notes, I'm like, I want to get on my knees and just like bow down to them, because it's rare enough that you can find somebody who just makes your life and your work easier at the same time, that those rare and valuable people are the people you'll take with you for the whole rest of your career.
Yeah, I 1000% agree with that. And I think that in many cases, we've become too transactional of, I have to, you know, I'm not just going to reach out because I want to build a bridge. It's more so, I just want the route to get there. Like, I don't care like how to get there. I just want to get there. And many people, young, older, whatever, have lost the art of building true relationships that aren't fully transactional. Like, yes, every relationship that you have may come with a transaction, but many times they don't. Like, we can know each other and like, oh yeah, I know Greg, I know Justin, but I'm not just reaching out because I want something from you or need something from you, or I want you to do something for me. Like, you can, like, there's going to be more value in conversation with someone that has no transaction tied to it, or it's delayed gratification. Cause we've had a lot of, you know, you said, you know, you did the project with the Sounders and then, you know, it was trying to build something off of that. But sometimes it just takes time. You know, the Sounders is a really beautiful brand, right? All of the Seattle brands are, you know, beautiful and vibrant. But maybe a couple of people that were looking at you were like, you know, they did it once. Can you do it again and again and again? And that's not enough. And sometimes I don't know if we as humans or people who are trying to get to a certain place at a certain time don't realize that just because it's a no today doesn't mean it's going to be a no next month or next quarter or next year. Some people it takes 4 years to work with, and you may not get a transaction right then. And so you don't just throw it away because it's not a transaction. That says more about you than it does that person that you're wanting something from, whether that's mentorship, whether that's a job opportunity, whether that's you know, a freelance project. Like, sometimes it doesn't come when you want it, and you just have to be okay with that and actually take that time to learn instead of trying to just get to the next thing and, you know, put something on TikTok or Instagram.
Like, I don't mind when people hit me up over and over again if they have something new to add. You know, like, hey, I've been working on this new skill this year. Here's my new thing. Like, but if they keep sending me the same stuff over and over again, it's less impactful. But I, like anybody, like to be surprised. And so, like, if people come to me, because I look at everything that people send to me at portfolios and stuff, because you never know what you're going to find, like, just a huge gem. The ones that don't get my attention as much is if somebody has a skill level or a visual voice that isn't better than what we're already doing. Like, what I need is people who push us beyond what we're currently capable of. So, like, somebody who's better at me is awesome at anything that I do. I will hire someone who's better at me and let them do something any day of the week, because I care about the final products more than I care about having my name written on everything. So somebody who's, if you're better at me than animating, if you're, or if you're better than our current people, or if you have a really unique visual voice, I'll see that. But if it's something that I've seen a million times before, it won't make an impact on me. So I think it's also really important that you have a unique vision of some sort, or you have the ability to show that your skill level in a specific thing is on an elite level in some way. That will catch my attention a lot more than somebody who I look at and I'm like, I actually could hire you for a certain kind of project, and I'll keep you in our database and maybe come back to you at some point, but doesn't feel like hiring them would be a difference maker in our quality. I probably won't be as likely to come back to them. I'll see somebody like, wow, that shit is crazy. Like, I want to find a project to like get them involved with. I'll remember them. I'll put an asterisk by their name. I'll come back to them. Cause like, you know, I want to keep expanding what we do. If they can make me look good for my boss, who is the client, and make my life easier, I'll remember you.
Yeah. So you talked about, and you know, we sent out these questions before the podcast, your love for storytelling. And talk about how storytelling drives, in a sense, what you do, whether it's in animating for a sports team or kids, of just telling stories. Because I think sometimes we also forget that, yeah, we're trying to wow people, but at the end of the day, we're also telling a story of whether it's the result of a game with highlights or a story of, you know, a good story or, you know, a heartfelt story or whatever. No matter what you do as a visual artist or creative, you're telling a story. So kind of lean into that a little bit for us.
Yeah, I kind of had this thought like a lot of years ago when I was looking a lot, when we were looking at doing a lot of branding work and stuff, and it works for kids. It also works actually especially well for sports. But like, I mean, I am a huge passionate believer that storytelling is a part of our DNA, that it is as fundamental as breathing, eating, procreating, all of that stuff. Like it is completely primordial, built into what we are. And it is a mechanism for us to figure out who we are, what we value, and what our place in the world is. This is why mythology has been so important throughout history, that the oral tradition and these myths that have been passed through time are so common across cultures, because there are certain storytelling structures that everyone has responded to in this super like primordial way. For me, I always look at it kind of this way. Like, to any individual who you're talking to as a brand and sports teams or brands, the most important story to that person is the story that's already going on inside their own head. The story that they tell themselves over and over again. We repeat stories to ourselves all day in our own brains because it is how we kind of, you know, keep our sense of identity going, our ego, you know, like what our politics, our place in the world, how we interact with people, you know, what I value, all that stuff is cycled in our brains through a story we tell ourselves all day. So we as storytellers can do a couple things. We can tell a story and somebody can watch that story. Or the thing that I actually feel, and you can do both of these at the same time, but the thing that I feel is most powerful, and the brands who get it are the best brands in the world, the Harleys, the Apples, things like that. If what you do is instead of trying to tell somebody a story or just do that, you contribute a verse to somebody that resonates enough with their internal story that they make it part of their own story. And this is what like Harley riders do. This is what like Apple people do. Like, it's like the brand is so involved with who I am as a person that they're inextricable. They're unpull-apartable. That's not a word. But like, if you can find a way into what someone's already thinking and get part of that story, first off, you get a lot of runs of your story. Like, you get yourself, they might see your thing one time, but they might run it in their head forever if it really strikes a chord in some way. So I think the most powerful storytelling is the kind of thing that people will bring into their own worldview in some way. So like when you're watching a story, and this can be done with storytelling, like we used to do longer form storytelling with the kids stuff, where we would tell a whole story. And you can still do the same thing. Like you can watch a story of redemption or a story of heroism or something like that. And you can pull that into your worldview and it does the same thing. What we do now is we do mostly short form content. And what I like about that is we are actually much more surgical in the way that we can hopefully just contribute a visual or a burst of emotion that can make just like that little tiniest impact into someone's world. Like I feel like if you can really study and you can figure out like who the audience is for this thing, what their worldview is, what their pride is, you know, what about their team or their brand or whatever do they see themselves in, and what part of that team do they value? You know, what keeps Pistons fans watching through the whole season, even though they've had just a record bad run? Like, what base level stuff do people see in their team and in their home city that keeps them coming back? Then you can tell something interesting. Like you know what the tone can be. You know what might be authentic to those people, and you can work within that. Instead of just saying I'm just going to do another hype video, you can change the tone on it a little bit depending on where the team is. Are they in a rebuilding season? Are they at the top of their game? You know, have they been out of it for a long time? Are they the way the Browns were for so many years, and the Lions? You know, are they the perennial hard luck team whose fans never leave them? Like, depending on where they are, there's going to be a different story running in the heads of the fans. And so like, if you can dig into that, if you can figure out some of that stuff, then I feel like you can get in there a little bit better and you can create something that feels authentic to the team and feels authentic to the fan, and hopefully will be something that will compound the feelings and the admiration they already have and the identification they already have with their home and with their team. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Makes all the sense.
So that's kind of my view on storytelling. Like, there's a couple of different ways to like think about storytelling, but I do think the most important one is like resonating with that internal storytelling that's going on in somebody's brain. If you can crack the code on that, then you are like, you can affect people much more deeply than you would be just by this transactional thing where somebody creates a story and you watch it or you read it or whatever like that. That's great too. But without the second thing, or without that internal monologue thing, it might not have the long-term resonance that it would have otherwise.
Yeah. Out of all the things you've done, what's one of your most favorite pieces or projects that you've worked on?
The two I thought where we were able to exercise some of those muscles the most, well, I guess there's a few of them, but I like with the project we did, the Christmas Eve one with the Chiefs, was actually really rewarding and really fun to work on, because we actually had a chance to like put a lot of this stuff into practice, where we, they came to us early on and they knew that they wanted to do something for their Christmas Eve game. And they had this kind of general idea they wanted to do Night Before Christmas. And so, one of the things that we always have to do with a client, if they're open to it, is like doing a little examination of why animation and what it's good at and what it's not good at, and use it as in the way that can benefit the team the best. Because like, honestly, sometimes animation could be too slight and it can actually hurt a team. And so like a lot of the original discussions we had about that were like, okay, so there's a lot of dangers here. A warm and fuzzy holiday and an animation form that people associate with kids. So like what can we do to do something that's completely different than that, and where we don't fall into a trap where this is cute, which we don't want, because at the time, best team in the NFL, full of swagger, fans were just like at the top of their game. Like they wanted to see their heroes big. They wanted to see them gritty. They wanted all that stuff. So like we were like, okay, so we got to not do that. We got to not go cute. We need to take the strengths that they have and turn them into a bonfire, not like dilute them by turning them into something else that's forgettable and cute. And so like in this process, like we did a lot of mood boarding, we did a lot of figuring stuff out. We had a few celebrities that they're great, because they're just like, they have celebrities on speed dial, and like they were like, they had a list. I don't know if I can say who the list was, but like most of them were like comedians who do a lot of work with them, like movie comedians, and then Tech Nine. And I was like, oh my God, it's got to be Tech Nine. And he's the least famous of all the people, but like he's huge. He's mighty famous among locals, and he's a huge fan, and he's got the right vibe to where we could do something. We could take it into a place where people would respect it and respect the authenticity of it, and a lot more of a street level kind of graffiti vibe, where it was something that felt like it was made in Kansas City by Kansas City fans and in a scrappy way. And so like, so once we nailed that down, we were able to figure out what all the creative decisions would be after that. And the nice thing about Christmas is it's great, because there's so many totemic things about Christmas. There's so many symbols of Christmas. So we were able to like mix and match like Easter eggs of the team and symbols from Christmas, but we wanted to do it in a way that every scene informed kind of what what was happening with the player. Like if we had a player in a scene, we wanted this creative tension between the cuteness of the holiday and the badassness, or whatever you want to call it, of the style and of the confidence and bravado of the team. And so like, putting having the scene where Patrick Mahomes is the one on the scene with like the Nutcracker ballet dancers behind him, but it's in this dreamlike setting, and then kind of having these really very grungy kind of nightmarish settings, but with with the sleigh in the background, with Tech Nine kind of very very like dolled out in this almost like 300 kind of way as a Persian prince, almost sitting on a giant present. It's like all these juxtapositions between the Christmassy stuff and then the more, I hate the word edgy, but edgy stuff that we put in there. Like the creative tension you can build if you have that juxtaposition and you really nurture it, I think created a really nice vibe that was really fun to work with. And also allowed us to make something that was essentially a hype video, but still had a hit of the holidays built within it, almost like a stealth hit of the holidays. So that one was really fun, because we had a lot of creative problems to solve. We also were so excited about it, we basically shut down everything else. And Ian and I worked, Ian, who's my creative partner, the creator of all of our visuals, we basically shut everything else out. And he and I just worked on that for like 2 months and did everything ourselves. Cause we were just like, we want to try stuff out. We want to have fun, and not have to like, you know, bring in a whole lot of people in here, just experiment with stuff. So that one was a complete playground. It got it, gave us a chance to experiment with new styles, also really to put some of these storytelling things into action, and really activate some of those theory things that, you know, I like to talk about, but you never know if they actually work in practice. Some of those theory things, about, storytelling. And it was a big hit with the fans. The fans really, really enjoyed it. So it was great to see, the reaction it got. So I think that was probably one of the most, the projects I was most proud of, from top to bottom. Also got to send a shout out to, Jordan and Rob at the Chiefs. They're just awesome to work with. Really value creative, really value adventurousness in their creative. And they also really know their brand, and they really have a, they really are very finely tuned to what their fans need to hear and what their brand needs to communicate. So they were delightful to work with because they got it. They just got all the stuff. And, that kind of client is really awesome.
So we're going to play a little quick game here. Because us as creatives, we need a little excitement and fun as well, right? So let me pull out the timer here. And I'm going to give you a little precursor to what we're about to do. So we do a 30-second game where you can name as many things as possible based on the question. And, you know, sometimes we go with toolkits of like, oh, what do you take with? That's not what you're going to have. So don't think about that.
That pressure's on. All right. Get my game
so
face
So you
on.
Have 30 seconds to talk. Mm. I mean, to give us a number of hobbies that you like to do outside of work. In 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. I love hanging out with my family. I got 2 teenage kids. I dig graphic novels. I like tabletop games. I got a tabletop game group I get together with every week. Love, man, my favorite thing, my favorite hobbies, sitting on the porch with a cup of coffee, daydreaming. I cannot understate the value of that hobby for any creative. Just letting your mind wander. All right, what else I got? I'm in a skee ball league with my wife and some friends. Let's see, what else do I do? I love high quality TV shows.
There you go. You got that one in. You got that one. That one actually.
How many points did I get? Did I beat the other guests you've had on the show? And like what you said,
what was that, about 7 or 8?
It wasn't that many.
I think it was about somewhere in there. We've had some that were like rattled them off. Like, I think,
but let's be fair though,
it was different
yeah. Category.
So this is the first time we've done hobbies as a, some of the others were like, what's your toolkit every single day? Like, what are you taking with you every single day? And so, and that's programs, that's your laptop, your phone, you know, social media, all that. So this was the first of its kind for you.
What's the preferred tabletop game?
Oh, that's a good question. We've been playing the crap out of a game called Marvel Zombies. It's the Marvel Zombie side. It's great, man. It's like a, man, you're fighting zombies. It's great. Couldn't recommend it more highly.
Interesting.
All right. So last thing we'll ask, this is obviously a podcast where we like, you know, storytelling and learning about the guest and their journeys, but we also like to like reach back and give the listeners, whether they are experienced or just starting out or maybe interested, a good piece of advice that you would like to just hand the next generation, whether that's animators, people in productions, or whatever part of the industry that you would like to give some advice to.
I think I got 2. Get to know what you're good at, what you're bad at, and shore up your weaknesses by finding other talented people who are better at you than at the things that A, you're not good at, and B, put off until the very end, but are important. Like finding somebody, if you're a creative, finding somebody who's good at business and project management, or if you are an animator, for instance, finding somebody who is an amazing illustrator who can do a better job than you are at that. Whatever your weaknesses are, find a team who can help you shore that up. That's the only way that you're going to get great. Very few people do any of this stuff 100% by themselves. I guess you guys are like, you know, there are the exceptions because you guys are awesome what you do. But like for what I do, like we probably have 11 people working for us right now. Like we need to pull in people who are experts at one thing. The second one, and this is particular for me, if I was giving advice to myself going back, I can be really good at starting stuff and I can be really bad at follow through. The only way I've gotten anything done in my career is by putting myself in a position where I had no other choice but to see it through. And that's where client work actually is great, or deadlines are great. Like if I put myself in a position where I have no other choice, I have to do it. I can't get lazy. Do that as often as possible. Put yourself in a position where you're not sleeping well at night. You're really worried you're not going to get this thing done. You're terrified that you are an imposter and you don't know what you're doing, but you have to figure it out. Because once you've done that 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times, you can look back and you're like, I've actually gotten better at stuff. But if you start stuff and you don't see it through, you'll never kind of get that in your system. So put yourself in a position where you have no other choice but to complete it and move on.
I like how you said figure it out. Right. Like, you know, sometimes we will give up or we will go on to the next thing because, oh, you know, this didn't work out. They didn't answer my one email. So I'm just going, but like, figure it out. Whether you get, you know, like you're in a similar position that I was, where you lose a position that was, you know, comfort, and you have to pivot out, but you have to figure it out in order to pivot. Mm-hmm. Like you don't just, oh, well, I'm over here now. This is just where I am. Like, figure it out. Justin figured it out.
Yeah.
You figured it out. I'm figuring it out. I haven't figured it out. This has been a great conversation of, you know, on a lot of levels of conversation. And we're glad that we finally got a chance to connect with you and really enjoyed learning about your journey.
Likewise. This is awesome, guys. Really appreciate being on the show. Awesome. Can't wait to hear it. I think I've talked too much, but, you know, whatever. I do that all the time.
That's the point. You're the guest.
It's your pod episode.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. Special thanks to APM for providing the music used in the podcast today. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're not a member and would like to join, go to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.